Welcome back to the Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr. Do you have or know someone who has a child? Have you noticed that times have gotten so much more intense when it comes to raising children, mostly because of the onset of social media? As we grew up, didn't have that in our lives. So parenting that is a totally different experience. And there have always been challenges with child raising and teenagers growing up and so forth. We were all once as well. And if you yourself don't have a child, what about your nephews, your nieces, or other people that you work with? What if you work with children? Joining me is Maureen Healy, who wrote a book called The Emotionally Healthy Child. And she addresses all of these issues where it comes with emotional health, resilience, equilibrium that can be learned and strengthened. Welcome to the show, Maureen. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So there is so much to talk about on this particular topic. What inspired you to write this particular book? You have a large background in working with children and with emotional learning and so forth. Why children here in this book, The Emotionally Healthy Child?
Sure. I mean, I just kept seeing over and over again that kids don't really know how emotions work and what to do with them. And it's natural. I mean, we all typically start out emotionally reactive, but when you know certain things and how to handle your emotions in a better way, you do better. So I just wanted to share that information with teachers and parents and grandparents. And like you said, anyone who is anywhere near the life of a child.
Have you seen things change with children over the past maybe decade in child raising?
I would say over the last 15 to 20 years, a lot of us who were maybe raised in either a stricter way or a way that parents didn't necessarily say, hey, I want you to feel happy. Not that they didn't want you to, but they had a different paradigm of what parenting was. I think those people are now parents and want to do it differently, want to really bend over backwards and make sure that children are not only fed and clothed and going to good schools, but that they feel confident and encouraged and empowered and can make good choices. So I do see a shift in what we're focusing on.
You do. Okay. And how would you start to teach children about social media when it's such a force of nature at this point in terms of their youth, their development? You can't keep them away from it because they'll find it from another friend and so forth. What is your perspective on how social media has shaped children these days and teens?
Well, I mean, I guess from my perspective, it's sort of a broader discussion as far as screens and when screens are a good idea and, you know, what kind of approach that is as far as moderation. Mm-hmm. But as far as social media, I typically deal with that with tweens and above. I mean, regardless of whether they have a phone or an iPad, like you just said, they're going to find social media sites. So helping mentor children to make smart choices off technology and then also regarding technology is essential. And listen, I have a bunch of tweens who have my cell phone number who call me after they've had episodes in social media that brought them to tears. So I know that it's a difficult experience with a lot of children, and helping them begin to make smarter choices. And I think that emphasizes sort of what my book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, is about, which is giving them that solid foundation for emotional health and to make better choices early on. So when they're faced with technology and bigger questions and more stressful things, that they have the confidence in themselves and they can navigate those big emotions.
You know, I have a question about that, about making smart choices, because I don't know if you were like this when you were a child, but the only way that I learned how to make smart choices was really, truly by making mistakes first. It's how you can listen to it all you want, but then when you feel the pain of making the mistake, you learn that lesson so much better. Isn't that really the case? I mean, we can prevent kids from making, you know, mistakes, but we really maybe shouldn't sometimes.
Well, I think that we all have the opportunity to learn from our mistakes. And then the reason I'm so dedicated to people making smarter choices, which I would say are good for them and good for others, are because as when children grow up, and let's say tweens and above, tweens in high school, they can make a really not-so-smart choice, and it can be someone's death. It could be suicide. I mean, there are choices that people make that you cannot take back. So we want to help them begin to make smarter choices instead of pushing the kid on the playground to walk away and use their words. So Mm-hmm. If we make mistakes, that's okay too, but we don't want to have them go down a path where they make a choice that's really a tragedy.
Yeah, that is true. Have you addressed with kids the rise in suicide rates amongst teenagers? This is one of the rapidly growing categories that breaks my heart. Is there a way to address this?
Yeah, I mean, I think someone who's going through true clinical depression, who, you know, decides that suicide is a good, you know, thinks it's a good choice, is really impaired and, you know, is making that permanent solution to a temporary problem. So that's why I'm such a big advocate for mentors and emotional coaching, because I think that every child and teen and needs someone outside of the family they can go to. So if for whatever reason they don't feel comfortable going to their parent, maybe they can go to a teacher or a community member, a therapist, a coach, someone where they can get that support that they need, because everyone has a bad day. And if you're going through a true funk or a true clinical depression, you do need outside help. So setting sort of a social network up, and when I say that, I mean like a real live people around that can help, I think is essential, because, you know, sadness and isolation, it leads to very poor choices.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different day and age with divorce rates being super high and kids going back and forth and back and forth. And there's other issues that could, you know, could be going on in the child's life. They may not want to see the therapist. They may not want to do that. How do you tell or not tell a child, but how do you allow a child to make the choice for themselves to seek out a mentor, to seek out help, without saying this is what you have to do, and then they resist and it turns into another battle?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of having dialogue and, you know, keeping the lines of communication open. And I think, like you just said, the important point is to connect on something, whether it's a TV show or something, and use these learning moments to say, hey, that person in that show, they look like they had someone to turn to. Do you feel like you have someone? We all need someone.
That's a good way of doing it.
Not telling them, like, mm-hmm. hey, you must do X, Y, Z, but just being a mentor and saying, hey, you know, nobody survives life alone. We're meant to live in communion or in community and with others. And there's a moment when everyone needs a little help, and that's normal and healthy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you ever teach, well, I know you do, but teaching mindfulness to children, how do you do that? How do you teach a child to visualize, to meditate, to understand the incredible benefits of mindfulness?
Yeah, it's a good question, because every child's different. So in the Emotionally Healthy Child, in my book, I have a whole chapter on mindfulness and lots of different ways to do it, because, you know, one child might like to draw a mandala. Another child might want to go for a walk where they slow down and begin paying attention to the birds and the, you know, the different things that they see. So there's activities to help them. And I usually don't use the word mindfulness. I try and help them recognize, you know, we have to pay attention. We have to pay attention to ourselves, and especially our feelings when they're small, before they get gigantic, epic size, and mm-hmm. we have a hard time controlling them. But if we can find them when they're really small, we can send them in whatever direction we choose. So mm-hmm. there's lots of different ways to do it, but of course you want to find the way that works for your child.
I mean, it could be a good way to address some of the anxiety that's happening in schools these days. Kids have anxiety about going to school because of the school shootings. We're dealing with a totally different day and age. The statistics of children that are experiencing anxiety and mood disorders has risen so drastically. Why? What would you tell a child who's scared to go to school because of a fear of school shootings or a fear of violence in schools?
Well, every, you know, geography is a little different and every situation is a little different, but I did participate in that Highlights magazine survey where they reported the number one fear on children's mind is school shooting. So, you know, I'd want to work with that child and help them to feel safe and secure, meaning there are unknowns in the world, but I want to partner with your school to make sure your teacher is safe, that we're doing everything we can. And I think that you're right. You know, the idea of the unknown is not something that goes away when you're in elementary school. You know, you come into life, and we had a natural disaster where I lived earlier in the year. So there are these things that are unknown in life. So it's how do you cope? How do you come back to center? And like you mentioned, mindfulness. If a child can learn how to be in that moment and calm and relax into that moment, then they can cope with the unknowns and the stressors of life a little bit better. And it helps them also realize, well, anxiety is, you know, you're feeling scared about what just happened, or you're afraid of what's going to happen, but you're not in the present moment. That's why the mindfulness or paying attention in the present moment helps bring a child back to their center and helps them calm. So giving them those tools to calm and relax, whether it's nightly before they go to bed or in a classroom setting, are essential to help them learn how to calm and center and not be so reactive to the world.
Mm. It's interesting because there's this movement where parents gave children a lot of choices. Like, well, what do you think about that? And why don't you make a choice on this and choose to do this and choose to do that? And there's a fine line between maybe giving a child three or four options and having him choose one, or just saying, all right, choose what you want on the menu. What do you think about those two different schools of thoughts?
Well, I think kids need structure. So that's what school and parents and homes can certainly provide for them, some structure. And I think they also need a choice on a lot of things, not necessarily everything. I don't think children their brains aren't developed necessarily to make the best choices all the time yet. So I think that they need our assistance. And I think it's one thing to say, hey, you can do your homework now, you can do it after dinner, you can do it in the morning before you go to school. I think it's another thing to say, hey, what do you think? What do you feel like doing on Saturday? I mean, there are certain choices you can give them that are helpful to them, that help them learn responsibility and self-reliance and time management. And there's other times where you need to really step up as the parent and say, okay, this is what we're doing for this holiday, and how do we make it the best? You can help them partner with them and help them participate, but I don't think that children need to make every choice, I guess, is my answer.
Mm. Interesting. What about attachment parenting? What do you feel about kids in the bed with you and kids, you know, attachment parenting? I don't know any other examples. I need another example.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on age. I mean, I think it's the family. You know, I mean, in Eastern world, you know, people sleep in the same bed for much longer than they do in the Western world, typically. So it really depends on your own parenting philosophy. I wouldn't say there's a one way that's right, one way that's wrong. But I think there does get to be a point in a child's development, especially, I think, you know, girls or boys, where they start having hormones and developing, and it's more appropriate for them to be in their own bed.
In the brain development stage, when does that critical thinking factor come in, come online? Does it? Does it come online in the teenage years?
There's two pieces of that which are very interesting. The first piece is I work with kids usually four and up, because that's when logic really starts to come online.
Okay.
But when we think of the brain fully formed, that's really not till the mid-20s. And your prefrontal cortex, which is judgment, is the last thing to fully come online. So that's why teenagers and adolescents, that's why it's such a difficult time, that they don't always make the best decisions, which is why they need that community around them to help them, or those mentors.
Very important. Where is your practice? What area?
I live in Santa Barbara, but I do work with people on Zoom everywhere.
Okay, so everywhere, which is great. In your practice, have you noticed there has been a change in kids themselves, in young adults themselves, in terms of the questions they're asking or the problems that they're having? Have you noticed a change?
And what do you mean specifically, the questions they're asking, like in regard to
their problems that they're dealing with and the struggles that they're having and so forth? Have you noticed that it's gotten more intense, I think I'm asking?
Well, I know that children are more intense in general. They're more emotional and more reactive, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book, Emotionally Healthy Child. So they feel things very deeply. But, you know, the same things that were happening 10 years ago are still happening in my office, as far as bullying is the number one problem I see, which is it never ceases to surprise me. And then there are other complications, like we talked about, like whether it's, you know, families that are not always sort of in conflict and different things. So I know that a child's life, from what I hear in my office, they have a very rich and sophisticated inner life that feels lots of things very deeply. And they may feel something deeply, but they don't yet have the experience to understand it, which is why it's so helpful to have someone guide them.
Or express it, yes. And expressing it really does help, even if you don't understand it. It sometimes does help. So bullying, you saying that is the number one issue. What are some solutions around that, and what have you seen really work?
Well, as far as schools going, I've seen schools that do more mindfulness and social-emotional learning and even, you know, compassion teaching, sort of not only empathy but compassion, help children. And also helping children really identify. Most of the children that come into my office don't even know what bullying is. They have a faint idea that it's when someone pushes you on the playground, mm-hmm. but they don't recognize it's also when someone's excluded. So there's a lot of different levels to bullying, and when they understand what it is, they are more self-aware, and then they become more aware not only not to be bullied, but not to bully anyone else when they're very clear on what it is.
Mm. So that helps, is that the bullier stops bullying, and then the person stops being terrorized at school, because that's it's got to work in both ways. Have you found...
Yeah, we need to sort of bring the bully into the mix, meaning, like, we don't just hit the bully his or her hand and say, bad bully, don't do that again. We say, okay... Obviously, you were either bullied and you're passing on that behavior, mm-hmm. or you learned that this is an okay thing. And in this environment and in any environment, it's not an okay thing. So how can we help you? So taking them into the mix and coaching them into making better choices versus saying you're bad and you're good.
Right. And then if that is happening to them, then it's a totally different situation. Would you find that that's a high incidence of kids who are doing the bullying are usually in some way being bullied themselves, either at home or in their family life?
Almost 100%. Mm-hmm. Almost 100%. And they don't realize it, because it's just behavior that's being passed on to them that they're passing on. They don't fully realize, oh, this isn't healthy. This isn't appropriate.
Mm-hmm. As parents that are going through anything emotionally, like, you know, say they're upset about the elections or they're having mm-hmm. financial issues and so forth, mm-hmm. how do you suggest having the kids be a part of that conversation without feeling the daily stress around it?
Right, right. Well, kids are so smart. They see through our BS anyway. They know what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think having age-appropriate discussions with them is important. So I don't think we always have to shelter them from things. Not that you want to tell them, you know, so-and-so has cancer and they're dying, but you might want to say something to the impact of, like, hey, you know, that's a family member that's, you know, not 100% well. Maybe we can bring them food, or we can pray for them, or whatever works in your family. And I think that if you're having a hard day, you tell your son or daughter, you know, listen, this wasn't an easy day for me. I had a flat tire, the car didn't start, whatever it was, but we'll make it through, and, you know, we'll do it as a family, and that's how life works. So, you know, some days feel better than others. That's just the nature of life. But we can learn from every experience, and especially if we are in it together. I think that's an essential piece, and that sort of soothes the child to know that no matter what, when there are things that are challenges, we make it through together.
I've always noticed that no matter what, the child is mirroring you no matter what you do, and mm-hmm. it goes on for as long as they're under your roof. So your mm-hmm. actions, even the unconscious ones, get mirrored. How do we notice, I mean, as ourselves, as adults, constantly be policing our attitudes and our reactions to things and always staying on the high road and so forth? How do you deal with that as an adult, knowing that your child is going to absorb whatever your reactions are?
Right. And I don't think we always have to be perfect. I mean, that's just not a fair bar to set. But I think that we need to be honest with ourselves and as honest as possible with our children, and really be open to the fact that we're learning together. You know, I'm a parent. I'm doing this parenting thing. You're my child. I'm learning how to be the best parent, and you're learning how to be the best child. And there'll be moments when I do it really well, and there'll be other moments where I screamed and I have to apologize, or it's good of me if I apologize, and I repair that relationship. So helping a child not only grow up feeling healthy and learn how to become happier, but also learning how to, you know, make amends and repair things and say I'm sorry and really mean it, and, you know, going through all the different emotions and growing together, I think is important. And also when a child is, quote-unquote, misbehaving, you know, look at what's in us, what's going on within me. Am I getting angrier and angrier and angrier, or are they just mirroring that back to me? How can I calm, and how can I sort of de-escalate the situation? And is there something for me to learn here? And maybe it's just that we have to begin again in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I love the fact that you take being perfect out of the picture, because now what about that child who is too hard on themselves, that strives for the perfection. They might, of course, pick that up from the home. But how do you teach a child to be more relaxed? And this insanity that we have with the standardized testing and the scores and the test scores and the colleges and all that, it gets a little bit crazy. How do you tell kids to back off on themselves?
Yeah, and I think that you hit it on the head earlier that, you know, when we tell them things, they just say blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
We sort of have to show them, and that means it's a practice. You know, even, you know, certain people who are more perfectionistic, it's something that you don't erase it. It's part of their personality, but you learn how to manage it. And it's helpful for children to recognize, as well as adults, that, you know, when we want to be perfect, or we want to get the perfect grade, or we want to get the perfect car, you know, that we think that those things will make us happy, but they actually don't. They make us temporarily happy, but then, you know, that whatever feeling comes back. So the idea is, if we can just give our best and let go of the rest, that's going to actually help us become happier. So just learning how to give your best, and then learning when it's, you know, that moment where, okay, I've done the best I could, I have to learn how to let it go. That's the practice. And the more you do that, you realize, oh, this feels a lot better than setting myself up to some unrealistic standard.
Yes. And have you addressed the overscheduled child? Have you noticed that a lot in your practice?
I do, because I work on the weekend, because it's hard for parents to come in during the week because their kids are so overscheduled. So, I mean, I think every child is different. Some kids really like certain things to do, and then certain sports are just very intense at certain times.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, there's a lot of joy and freedom to not being overscheduled and having that space and time to just be a kid, whether it's reading a book or going in the backyard or something that's more natural, I think, is helpful.
Sports these days really does that to kids. I mean, there's year-round sports. There's no breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There is a caller that wants to know how to deal with her 6-year-old separation anxiety. So the child just started school, and how to deal with that separation when a child is just starting to get into the school world. Young ones.
Such a good question. Yeah, such a good question, because, you know, certain children have that intense, it's almost as a, it, you know, it's like, it's why you have a teddy bear. You know, when you have that teddy bear at home, you feel soothed, right? Mm. And then eventually you're able to give the teddy bear, and you sort of can contain that feeling within yourself, and you can carry on. But right now she's having a hard time containing that feeling by herself, being able to soothe and be comforted and feel safe. So I would work with her to help her feel more comfortable and come up with some ideas. I sort of problem solve with her. How can we help you feel more comfortable and more safe? And do you need me to walk you to class every single day? I would work with the school to help sort of give her some flexibility,
right,
so that she can make this transition as easy and possible for her. So maybe she needs me there the first half an hour every day, and I got to just deal with what I got to deal with.
And that's okay.
And then I'm going to set the and then I would set the expectation after a week or two, I'm going to expect you to start doing it on your own. And I would reward and praise her for making the smallest progress and give her the confidence that, hey, you can do this. You got this. You know what I mean? You got this. Pretty soon you're gonna ask me not to come. And eventually it does happen where they're like, okay, I don't need this anymore. But in that window where she needs it, I would give her what she needs in a way that worked for you and the school. And it is likely a very big inconvenience and stress, of course, but it is temporary and this will pass.
I like that you preframe it like that. Yes, there's some schools of thought that just say, no, you have to leave right away and stop the, you know, the pain. Mm-hmm. And then they stop crying when you leave. And that's true. That could definitely happen because they get distracted. But that doesn't address the emotional pain of the separation. There's, you know, different schools of thought. If you stay around, then you could be drawing it out. However, what you just said was a great idea of pre-framing that I'll stay for a little while, but in the future, this is something that you'll get really happy with in terms of getting involved with school and other things to do, and I'll be back and those types of things, which is great. I know I'm jumping from young ones to old ones, but another question is coming in. What do you feel about parents allowing their children to drink as teenagers? Because it's so pervasive in the communities, and they figure if they want to do it or experiment, you might as well do it under my roof.
It's a very good question. I mean, I think that it depends on the child you have. I'm not a big fan of underage drinking and alcohol in general. I'm not a drinker at all, so I may not be the right person to ask. But mm-hmm. I do believe it depends on the child you have. There are kids who have more addictive personalities, and mm-hmm. I don't think that that would be a great option for that child. But right. I think if the family was making smart choices and the child, when I say underage, is like 18, 19, 20 versus like 13, 14, 15, if the child was, you know, college age, I think, and they were under the same roof and they knew the child was going to be drinking somewhere else, but they could keep them safe in their house and that anyone who was there drinking, they could get them home safely, I think that's not a bad choice. That's actually how my parents parented me.
Right.
So I'm not against that, but I think it's a family decision, and I think everyone has to be really honest and clear with the other parents so they know if you're going over XYZ's house, there'll be booze, and that's just the deal. The parents are there, and they're
right.
watching, but that's what's on the table.
The parents are there, yeah. And I don't know the statistics, but there was a speaker that came to my daughter's school talking about, I think he said, if you start drinking under the age of 15, then the incidence of addiction as an adult is like really high, in the high 90s to 100%. Very high. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. I mean, I think that you're saying exactly you could set up a person to have an addictive personality, especially when you combine it with the stress they're under as teenagers and the overscheduling and the testing, and then you give them an option to have a drink, which then gives them a break. It's an accident waiting to happen. All right. Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate you being on today and for all the information. The name of the book is called The Emotionally Healthy Child. And my guest is Maureen Healy. Sorry. She's in Santa Barbara, but you can look up her website, which is growinghappykids.com. That's growinghappykids.com. And I know that parenting isn't the easiest thing and we stumble through it, but there's different ways to be able to learn and educate yourself as you're going through this process. I highly recommend it. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I loved our first guest, Marcy Javril. She talked about the best head massage you'll ever get or give. And you can look up her website, which is yogaoftouch.com. Remember, you can also go to my TV show. You can check out at inspirationsongaia.com. That's inspirationsongaia, GAIA.com. And I have 8 seasons. I'm on my 9th seasons of inspirational shows on that network, which really, really, really is helpful, especially in our stressful environment and chaos in our world. It's so nice to have an hour of an oasis in your day. I am Lisa Garr, and I thank you so much for being a part of the show. Thank you, Gina Salvati, for executive producing, and Joyce Walker for producing, and our wonderful engineers here at KPFK, and you for listening. Your energy makes the show happen. Until next time, I invite you to stay aware.